Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes. My name's Carl Shinneman. I'm Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov. And the purpose here at ESI Bytes is to bring together national speakers to talk about critical issues in electronic discovery and records management at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and at a time when people might be interested in the topic regardless of where they're located. Today we're going to talk about alternative approaches to privilege logs, and I know I always say I'm extremely excited by the topic before we start a show, but just like I said last week on the show with Judge Grimm, today I really mean it. You know, first of all, I know I speak for both Megan O'Donnell, the other speaker, and myself. It's always a pleasure to do a podcast with Judge Facciolo. It's very entertaining, and of course, Judge Facciolo is a U.S. magistrate judge for the U.S. District Court in the District of Columbia. He's well known in the field. His opinions are some of the most widely cited. He writes with clarity, at times great humor, offering guidance sometimes to both parties on how they should be behaving and handling ESI matters. Some of his better-known cases are Disability Rights Council of Greater Washington versus Washington Metro Area Transit Authority, United States versus O'Keefe, Equity Analytics LLC versus London, Peskov versus Faber, and many others. Frequently speaks around the country and has graciously given his time to the field to assist with hundreds, maybe thousands of, hundreds and hundreds of presentations around the country. Megan O'Donnell's an associate at the AmLaw 100 law firm of Hunt & Williams, and she's in their litigation and IP practice groups. What I like about this is Megan's a second-year associate, so we're going into the trenches a little bit, which doesn't happen very often in e-discovery education. I think it should, but she's already taken a very active role in organizational collection efforts of ESI from Fortune 500 companies in pre-merger situations and class action litigations. She's organized and led a two-day training course on e-discovery. And importantly, recently she published an article called Alternative Privilege Log Techniques in the e-discovery World, published by the American Bar Association in the winter of 2009. She's a graduate from the College of William & Mary Law School and University of Notre Dame. In addition to the great speakers, this topic's very interesting. It's intimately tied in with search and retrieval. It's the space I work in professionally, so it seems like at this time, the legal profession is really starting to take notice of this area, which makes it doubly exciting. Several weeks ago, the Sedona Conference issued its commentary on achieving quality in the e-discovery process, which highlights the need for more quality in finding ESI and searching and retrieving. So with no further ado, let's start the show. And first of all, duplicative question for you, Judge Facciolo, but new one for you, Megan. How did you first get interested in electronic discovery?
Why doesn't Megan go first?
Okay.
Sure. Thank you. And thank you for inviting both of us to speak today. I'm extremely excited to be able to discuss this and share some ideas. I first got interested in electronic discovery particularly because I was hired to work at Hunt & Williams to work in their electronic discovery practice group. When I started at Hunt & Williams in 2007, I could barely operate a computer beyond accessing email or saving law school notes to save my life. But I just fell into a great, wonderful practice group that involved themselves in e-discovery and advising clients on the issues that they should be aware of as they were involved in much litigation across the country. I summered with this group in 2007. That was the group that I actually received the offer from, and ever since I have immersed myself in the strategy of e-discovery, in boning up on as much information as I could, as much case law as I could. I like e-discovery because it's constantly evolving. It is not the same thing every day, and every day with every new case, you receive a new challenge. There are no black and white areas. A lot of it has to do with the keyword of reasonableness. Which to everyone needs something a little bit different, I think. So I like the fact that it is a challenge and that with respect to the facts evolve that you can advise your client differently.
And Judge Facciolo, for those who didn't hear your first podcast or
what? Well, I was sitting here minding my own business about 11 years ago, and a case came across my desk called McPeak versus Ashcroft. I was handling it as I would most e-discovery cases, but I realized that it presented a whole new set of things that one had to consider because of the scope and because of this enormous data set that had to be gone through. So using the traditional powers and skills and reasoning of a judge, I talked a little bit about that and wrote an opinion. The next thing I know, I was being called an expert, God help me, and I haven't had to buy lunch since. So, like Megan, I always point to my own career when I talk about developing competence in this area. I can't pretend that I knew anything about that before I began to write that opinion. While I've always been interested in computers, it really has more to do with my hobby of photography. It had very little to do with anything else, although I've always been fascinated by data processing and systems like that. So I guess my own career is a pretty good example that if you just, like Megan just said, if you just try to keep educated, it's amazing how much you can learn.
And it's like quicksand. Once you get in, you can't get out, huh?
Well, it's not. No, I don't think it's that's a poor analogy. I think it's more like any area that the more you understand it, the better, the more fun it is because the more variations on a theme you see.
I agree with that. Well, Your Honor, how do parties typically get in trouble in the privilege area with disputes?
Well, I think the first problem they have is, as Megan will agree, we have seen the most dramatic increase in the capacity of depositories of electronic stored information to keep growing. The larger the depository, the less inclination there is to manage it pursuant to a records managed policy. It's the people get in trouble in the first place by not having a records management policy. In this particular area, they don't have a consistent policy that identifies privileged material at its creation and attempts to segregate it from so that it can be retrieved in a disciplined fashion, and also and that they can go to court and say, Your Honor, we have a system here, and our system is designed so that we know all the privileged information is here and in no other place. Since they don't have that system, then, God help us, the search generates an immense amount of information, and then we get into the problems stressed by Megan in her article of the nightmare of manual review, which, given the size of storage capacity, the notion that we can even do it anymore seems to be disappearing.
I would agree with that, but I would also add, I think, a second problem with respect to being able to store that privileged information separately is also the tendency of people to put privileged and confidential on a lot of material that really isn't. And so when you do start to search material for perhaps privileged information, you render back a much larger set than you would anticipate or that is true and authentic based on this tendency to over-label things.
That's a good point. Well, let's talk about the actual process of privilege review. And Megan, as a younger associate, you've seen the guts of the e-discovery process maybe more recently than most of my guests on ESI Bytes. Or maybe you're just not set in your ways yet, as an older professional might sometimes get, open to new ideas. So tell me, what spurred you to write about a new approach to privilege log review?
Sure. Within my first year of being an associate at Hunton, I was assisting my co-author, Elizabeth Timkovich, in a very large document review and privilege review and log that she was spearing up, and I was assisting her and also volunteering some quality control on that privilege log as well. And I do not recall the exact number of documents that were set to be reviewed to begin with, but I do know the set of documents that were set for privilege review was somewhere north of 30,000 documents, which is pretty excessive to go ahead and do not only the manual review of every single document, but also logging the information manually was quite tedious and took a number of weeks at a cost of, I'm sure, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And based on the tool that we were using, we knew that there was the ability to populate metadata if we did want to request that type of custom directive, that custom work order. And so we set about to talking about it, about what we could do differently to make it easier, assuming that both parties would agree. Now, generally, the process is you have your set of documents based upon a first-level pass review you have identified as potentially privileged, either due to attorney-client communication privilege or work product privilege, or perhaps, depending on your case, perhaps even joint defense privileges. Then you take that set and send it back through for a more scrutinized privilege review, and at the same time, typically you want to log the information. The tool that we were using allowed us to both manually enter information in coding fields as well as manipulate drop-down menus to populate various coding fields with information that would be exported into a simple Excel spreadsheet as the privilege log. It looked nice and pretty when it was done, but all of the labor that went into it was definitely not. The fields that you would typically use would be For example, the majority of data was emails and attachments. So the coding fields that we used would populate information such as the to field, the addressee, the author or the from field, any CCs or BCCs, a date, the basis for the privilege, either attorney-client or work product. And then we used a number of descriptor fields to describe whether it was between or among attorneys or clients, the name of the attorney or law firm to whom the privilege was attaching, and a regarding issues line. Now, that's somewhere north of 12 separate fields that we were asking our review attorneys to populate or data enter for us. And again, it took weeks. And from there, it had to go to firm attorneys to quality control, review, and change, and then to the very top tier of second-level reviewers. So this did take a number of weeks. And as we talked to the electronic vendor throughout the process, we came to realize that there was a way that we could have the metadata that was inherently attached to the document populate in the coding fields. And while it may not be completely accurate because the metadata that would populate would be the last-in-time metadata attached to an email chain, for example, we did realize it was a step in the right direction if we wanted to cut a lot of time and manual effort out of the way. So that's kind of how this article came about, and I can talk a little bit more about it when we get a little bit further into the discussion.
Great. Well, you painted a vivid picture of 30,000 documents with all these steps and the time. Judge Facciola, you've been one of the first vocal critics of the toll that manual review is taking on our best and brightest young lawyers and hurting professionalism in the practice of law. This audience might not have heard you give some of the speeches you've given on this point. Could you offer a brief summary of your concerns?
Yeah, as I've tried to say, in one of the articles I wrote about here, I tell a story of going sailing and having invited this dear young friend of mine to come with us, and she couldn't come because she had to go back to the office and do a privilege review. One point during the summer, she had to go, I don't believe this, as hard as it is to believe, she had to work with a vendor to open up certain computers so she could ascertain whether there was any privilege material in the slack space of a computer. I think I'd rather die. But my point is that we can't take brilliant young people like Megan and create systems where the manual review of this is so draining, so exhausting, that it just saps out of them all the enthusiasm they have for the practice of law. And it concerns me greatly. I'm terrified because my young friends are telling me that too frequently, sometimes e-discovery is seen as kind of the elephant's graveyard of young people, and people resist the assignments to those places. Obviously, Megan is working with wonderful people who've got her excited and interested in this. But for a lot of these people, and particularly the young contract attorneys who do this and nothing else for extensive periods of time, I can't imagine why they would remain interested in the practice of law.
Megan, would you call yourself an example of a young lawyer fighting back and offering a better alternative here?
I don't know if I would say fighting back, but I definitely want to shake up the old set way of doing things. And if there's any field to do that, it would definitely be e-discovery. I mean, this is not a repeat of the way that we did things yesterday, or at least it should not be. And with, you know, the loud echoes of let's cooperate and let's find new and reasonable ways to do things in the electronic discovery world, then I think this is a perfect example of a way that we can do that. But I agree. I think the old ways of doing privilege logs are causing more harm to the practice of law and, honestly, to the company's financial well-being that are defending these actions or pursuing these actions than it causes a benefit to the receiving party that would be receiving this privilege log. So I think most of my challenge has to do primarily with the manual entry required of privilege logs than the manual review of privileged documents just for the review and substance of it. But, yeah, I definitely think this is a wonderful field to shake things up.
If I could be creative like Ralph Losey in his blog, I'd have the Rocky music playing right now or something like that. But but anyway, I'd like to talk a bit about the quality and cost issues associated with manual-driven privilege reviews or any manual-driven review, for that matter, of a large corpus of documents. You know, more parties are sifting for relevant evidence by using technology, but they for some reason still feel compelled to plod through privilege reviews using page-by-page human review approaches. And, you know, the question I want to ask is, does this really make sense, given the fact that, as Judge Batchel mentioned, that data is growing astronomically, and the costs are skyrocketing, the quality of review is erratic, and, as we mentioned earlier, the profession's being eroded?
You know, one thing we have to bear in mind is in our hubris and in our arrogance, we human beings think that we're good at this. Actually, every statistical and other survey shows that actually human beings are very poor at this. That is, if you took a group of people, as these studies have done, and put them in a room and gave them the same database, almost you would get extraordinarily variations in what they considered privileged and not privileged. So there is no showing whatsoever that human beings are particularly good at this. And human beings get tired, human beings get bored. As I say, the supervision of the people at the lowest level of this doing it page by page, email by email, it's almost hard to imagine how you could supervise that process. So one thing we have to get out of our heads is that we want to begin with the notion that doing human review of every single email is the optimum way to do this. The converse may be true. It may be the poorest way to do this, and therefore the systems that people that Megan are suggesting may not only be advanced by cost considerations and efficiency considerations, they may substantively prove to be the better solution. To a lot of lawyers, that sounds counterintuitive, but they have to be made to understand the deficiencies in manual review that they may not appreciate.
Well, Megan, your article is really fascinating reading, and would you care to outline some of your tips on how to use metadata to populate a privilege log and what the underlying process would be?
I'd be happy to. But just to add one extra point to the judge's comment on the previous question, I think you also need to consider as well that at this point, searching technology is just not accurate enough to be 100% perfect. And if it's not accurate enough to render completely responsive sets, then how likely is it that it would be able to render completely privileged sets as well? So I agree that human review is definitely not 100% perfect or anywhere near, but we're also kind of stuck in the era where technology has not reached that perfection as well either.
The point I think that we sort of have to come to is, mm-hmm. my dear friend Pat Ott puts it so well, the perfect is the enemy of the good. From a judicial posture, I can assure you, I never insist upon perfection, mainly because I'm supervising human beings, not angels. Therefore, what is reasonable is what is good, and that's, I think, an important consideration.
Definitely. And as a litigator representing companies, I truly appreciate that mindset that it is all about the reasonableness and the procedure as opposed to the outcome. But to answer your question, Carl, yes, the concept behind what Elizabeth and I proposed in our article was to, first of all, get an agreement with your adverse or your opposing party. Nothing like what we are proposing would be able to recommend without getting that agreement first off and foremost. And we think that it might work better when you are in a situation where the volume of documents is so large on both sides that your opposing party would be more likely to follow these procedures rather than a situation where one side has the bulk of the corpus of the documents to review and the other side does not. The procedure itself is to, first of all, know what review tool you are using. Different technology, different tools have different ways to populate fields based on the metadata of a document. Some are more advanced than others. Some may have this ability ready to go, where others may need to enter a custom work order to do it. The basic concept is to have metadata associated with the to lines, the from lines, the CC, the BCC, all be able to be pulled out and put into a document coding field. This would also require the date field to populate. Once all of these fields are populated, you could also extract, if you had been reviewing these documents manually and had selected a tag or a categorization for attorney-client or work product, you could also have the fact that it had been tagged with that type that basis of privilege to also populate. Go ahead. You have a question?
No, no.
Okay. Once all of this data is populated, you can export it into a spreadsheet along with the document's image or control number, as well as the family ID, because at some point you may want to keep families of documents together. Now, all of these fields are very easily exported by most technologies today. And again, you want to get to an agreement with the opposing party that this is the information that you intend to provide. Once you were to provide this draft privilege log or this template privilege log to the opposing side, the opposing party could identify for you which documents they may be interested in receiving more information about. Now, one other technology that is available in most of the review tools is the ability to run keyword filters. So typically, in a lot of the cases that we handle, we run a potentially privileged filter at the very beginning of a document review to isolate for the document reviewers that a certain document might have the name of an attorney in it or something that says privileged and confidential. Doesn't necessarily mean that the document is privileged, but it highlights for them that they should scrutinize that document more carefully. Along the same lines, similar technology can be used to run keyword filters, if you will, of privileged words, maybe such as, you know, prepared at the request of counsel, or if you have a set of attorney names that you believe are the basis for the privilege in these documents, you can run that keyword search against the set that you have populated metadata with, and if the documents hit on specific words, you can also export that information, the words that hit on that document, as part of your exported spreadsheet. So that's kind of the theory, is to export just this metadata and allow the other side to come back and request more information. It's not about eliminating all manual review, because at some point, you know, even privilege reviews and logs that are created manually are going to be challenged by opposing parties. So the goal is not to eliminate every single bit of manual review or every single bit of providing privileged information or the basis for the privileged information, but the goal is to eliminate the quantity of it, and quantity equals cost to our clients.
Do you see support for the from the federal rules on doing this type of a process? I mean, that might be one of the concerns some of the listeners have.
Right, and that was actually one of my key concerns when I first started talking about it with Elizabeth. But we looked at Rule 26, and under Rule 26, I really only see two requirements to being able to successfully claim privilege over documents, and that's one, to expressly say that I'm withholding this document because it is privileged. And the second is to describe the nature of the document to some extent. Now, that's not very clear what it means to be the nature of the document, but the technology that we used, we can export what type of document is it. Is it an email? Is it a Microsoft Word document? Is it a PowerPoint presentation? And so that would fulfill, I believe, that second requirement.
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't agree.
Okay.
Here's where we are and why when I wrote about this, I talked about how do we square the circle. How do I tell you why the document is privileged without disclosing the document, the document's very nature, so that you know why it is privileged and you learn what the privilege is and you learn why I called it privilege in the first place? I have done this experiment 100 times. I've taken a room full of lawyers and judges, and I've gone through 3 different privilege logs, each one a little more specific. By the time I hit the second one, all the lawyers in the room have said, that's too much. And all of the judges have said, that's not enough. I never get to the third one. So the problem I'm constantly having is, can I look at this privilege log as a judge and instantaneously know why this document is privileged? The answer to that, more often than not, is that I can't, which leads me inevitably to in-camera submission. The problem we're having now with in-camera submissions is they're becoming simply impossible. Judge Shinlin, I think, has a case in which there are 30,000 entries on a privilege log. I mean, are we kidding? That's one judge and a pencil. What is she going to do? So I think that really is where the rubber hits the road. How do we use the processes that Megan is talking about so that the description of the document meets the requirement of the rule that says that it must be sufficient in itself to disclose the privileged nature of the document? All too frequently, it's Smith to Jones, attorney-client privilege, which, of course, doesn't get you there at all. And I think that's where that rule and its interpretation by the courts is the most troubling aspect of this, I'm sure, from the lawyer's perspective, because they think the judges may be being very unreasonable given what has to be logged in terms of sheer numbers, and how are you supposed to do this without letting the cat out of the bag in the first place?
When I was reviewing this Rule 26 issue, and I came across some notes that were found in the 1993 amendments, and it discussed the fact that if you are going to be providing this information, such as the people involved, or the nature of the communication, or the general subject matter, there may become a point when the sheer volume of documents that you would need to provide this information for may be so large that renders itself unduly burdensome, and I know that's a hot key phrase in our area. So I guess, Your Honor, I would ask you to what point that might really become applicable when you are looking at all of these privilege logs, the fact that providing all that information for tens of thousands of documents would become unduly burdensome.
Yeah, I think that then the answer to that, Megan, is how did we get there in the first place? Why do we have these 10,000 documents? What efforts have been made to get out of this, to take the wheat from the chaff, and so we really get down to those documents that are truly relevant to this case? The problem I'm constantly having is overproduction. In other words, the filtering for relevance doesn't seem to have been done. So I will go through the privilege logs, or as I'm doing right now, and begin to look at the emails themselves and saying to myself, well, privileged or not, it doesn't have anything whatsoever to do with this case. How did this even get there in the first place? And that's a constant problem I'm having. So to answer your question, when it becomes overly burdensome, I first look as to whether or not someone has truly filtered this down so that the documents at issue truly meet the requirement of relevance under the rules.
I definitely agree, and I do not think that we would propose this approach until that relevance review had been complete.
Yeah.
Definitely, yes.
That gets us to actually using the technology to do some better searches and maybe statistical modeling, or trying to, you know, determine if these buckets of information really contain relevant data. But, and Judge Facciola, one of the concerns about using technology to find privileged documents is people aren't very good at devising search terms. I mean, Megan pointed the finger at technology letting us down, but sometimes it's the people entering the information into the technology. And if the process starts with finding the privileged document somehow, and Blair Marin and the work of Trek are good at places to see human limitations on finding relevant information just by running keyword searches. So if we're going to follow Megan's suggestion of using more of the technology to compile, how do we get comfortable with what we're missing?
Well, I think we have to begin that the parties have to start at the very beginning, at the inception of the process, and eliminate almost immediately that portion of the data set that can't possibly be relevant to this case. Now, the word buckets, for example, we would have one bucket where we know the material in it in terms of date can't possibly have any relevance to this. Then we have another bucket of our custodians. We know there were 12 people actively involved in this deal. The other 24 were peripherally involved, but it doesn't appear that they would have anything to do. So that would be another bucket. So the point is, before we begin to submit this data set, to a search, we're going to have to eliminate by buckets materials where we aren't even going to search at all. Now, that may sound heretical, but as storage capacity increases, I'm beginning to wonder what possible alternative do we have. And the lawyers before me who are sophisticated in this area are doing that. In other words, in their meet and confers, they're focusing a lot on elimination, on where we don't have to look as opposed to where we do. That doesn't make the problem that Megan has already referred to, that no search engine is perfect, go away. But at least it permits that engine to operate on a more manageable data set. That's not the perfect solution, but we are going to have to use methodologies that are familiar to us. And I think it's very important. My friend John Rosenthal says that one of the words being thrown around in this area all too freely is the word statistical sample. That has a very precise meaning in the science of statistics. And if we are going to have to inform ourselves how it operates, that's not new to us. We use statistical sampling in antitrust cases. We have used it in the civil rights cases since their inception. but I see it coming back as a crucially important part of this entire analysis. How do we know that the set that remains after we've eliminated this stuff that we don't think is relevant at all, how can we say of that set that it would yield the information that we are most likely to want to have? And I think that becomes a scientific question on which, if the parties cannot agree, we're going to have to look for some scientific information.
Well, that's good points there, and I'll throw out one quick plug for your firm, Megan, or for Sherry Harris at your firm. She did a really nice podcast on e-scoping.
She did.
The first point that Judge Batchel raised about really getting smart about what you're trying to collect before you start searching. Okay, now if we're looking at the problem of actually now you've got it down to a manageable amount. How, Megan, as an outside law firm, do you deal with the skill barrier needed to do effective search and retrieval? Is this something you have in-house all the time, or do you partner with outside experts? Do you have advice for other lawyers facing this issue?
Sure. I think that it all depends on the complexity and the exposure of the case and on the sophistication level and cooperation with the opposing party, because no one case is identical, and I think that the efforts required for each are different based on those criteria. To this point, on very low-risk cases or third-party responses to subpoena, those types of issues, typically when we do not anticipate a lot of sophistication or adversity from the party issuing the subpoena, we typically take the whole keyword devising task in-house, but we do not rely solely in-house. If there are other merits counsel involved, we take a look at the subpoena or the complaint, take a look at some exemplar documents, devise a draft list. We also take notes that we've had after talking to the various custodians that we've collected from, because no one custodian is going to treat the same issue alike or have the same phraseology for it. So the goal is to encompass as much of both what is on the exemplar documents and subpoena, as well as the way that the custodians truly treat the issue, and make sure that you leave enough ability to broaden that scope. We always try to run some sort of early processing metrics on our list of keywords, so that if the number of hit documents is too low or too high, we realize that we need to do some more work before we can be ready to truly render this set for review. In cases where there may be more of an exposure or when we think the sophistication is high or we see that cooperation may or may not be an issue, we'll follow those same steps, but then we'll take it to the opposing party and say, these are the keywords that we've devised. This is why we think it's reasonable. Why don't you comment back or confirm that you are happy with this, and we'll run processing metrics, and then we'll discuss it some more. Now, granted, all of that is assuming that it's not on an expedited schedule, which a lot of times, especially if you're in the rocket docket, it is. So those are just some different steps that we've taken. Now, we've also become involved in some higher risk and higher profile cases, and we're beginning to, based on some recent case law that's come out in the past 8 or 9 months, about searching and the need to really spend more and more thought and time and effort into these searching techniques, to reach out to people that are considered experts in the field. But we haven't really defined yet a process for that, at least on my own end. I can't speak for all people at my firm, but for the cases that I've been involved in since this article came out, at least, they have tended to be more on the lower risk side.
Well, yeah, let's move in the process here a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about one of Judge Grimm's opinions, Victor Stanley versus Creative Pipe. And Victor Stanley, 165 privileged documents slipped by privilege review employed by keyword searching and a cursory sounding title page analysis for non-searchable items. An important factor in this case was there was no clawback agreement in place. Plaintiffs found these privileged documents, turned them over to the court. I think importantly, the court found privilege was waived because of the lack of a defined process. I mean, the defendants couldn't explain how they devised their search terms to find privilege documents. You know, we already talked a little bit about volumes of data, and we talked about the issues of how you run search terms through appropriately defined information. First part is, are clawback agreements a big part of the answer? is developing a defined process like Megan talked about, is that part of the solution? I mean, what are your thoughts on those two questions, Judge Facciola?
Well, I think the clawback is nice to have. It's, you know, wearing a belt and suspenders. But I think, as Megan has pointed out, if you're down to clawback and that's the only thing you got left in the car, boy, you know, the car's about to go over a cliff because somebody made a mistake, the fact that you have to claw it back. But I think Megan's point about having the process set up in the first place is crucial. Where this all works out, I think, you have to remember that the Victor Stanley case anticipates and is decided before 502 becomes effective. Now 502, Rule of Evidence 502, in permitting a judge like me to bless an agreement that the parties have made and to find that it doesn't constitute a waiver, will require me to find that they have made reasonable efforts. So the clawback is not as important, it seems to me, as the 502 argument that the parties are going to agree to and how they are going to convince each other that the efforts they have made are reasonable. Now, a nice question presented, and I don't know where you come out on this, is could you have such an agreement without making those reasonable efforts? I don't know. But the theme of 502 is that if reasonable efforts are made, they should get a judicial blessing because the parties have done everything they can to truly search and find the privileged materials. So the legitimacy of that agreement is a direct function of the process that Megan has talked about and convincing a judge that that did what it was supposed to do.
Well, Judge Facciola, if we're going to enable parties to experiment more with devising better processes, you mentioned John Rosenthal's discussions about statistics that you've had, and and incorporating some of these new tools, I mean, random samples to verify your search and your review, maybe working in some concept searching with algorithms or linguistic tools. I mean, these are all different tools and processes that a lot of vendors are talking about, but it involves not putting eyeballs on every document. What in the law is going to support this type of approach?
What I just said, if these tools can be verified, that is, that if the judge can find that they are a reasonable way of doing things, then those efforts are reasonable, which would then permit the judge to conclude that the agreement that the parties have reached, that will suffice, is a reasonable agreement, and the judge will approve it. Now, in terms of judicial capacity to understand all that, well, obviously, that's going to require a lot of judicial education. But as I say, these concepts are really not foreign to courts. That is, courts deal a lot with deriving a conclusion about an entire universe on the basis of limited evidence with reference to that universe. We never could have concluded, as we did in the civil rights cases, that women were discriminated against, for example, in a particular examination at the Foreign Service by reading every exam. What we needed was to someone to tell us that the results of those exam were so askew with the science of statistics that it had to be because the questions were discriminatory in either their operation or in their effect. So courts are ready to be made to understand that. And if you keep giving them 30,000-page privilege logs, I assure you they'll figure out a way to do it.
Megan, I'm going to ask you this question first, and I think Judge Facciola just answered it from his impression. But one of my past panelists asked me to ask Judge Facciola, does he believe a court would give a seal of approval to a non-page-by-page privilege review? And they were referencing some of Judge Grimm's opinions. And your article, Megan, supports this approach as well. But do you see some practical issues with getting judges to bless this?
I think the biggest practical issue might be for judges and members of the judiciary who are not as finely attuned to this as Judge Facciola is. And just as he mentioned just before, if they're not comfortable with the way that technology operates, then they may not be willing to bless this as much as he is. And I think that, at least from a representing a company standpoint, I don't know if necessarily our clients or all of them will be ready for this as well. Granted, they're not ready for the cost that manual review is going to entail, and some may be looking for these cost savings. But in the end, if privileged information gets out because you did not do a manual page-by-page review, regardless of the amount of money that was saved, the company still may not be happy because that privileged information was seen by the opposing party. So I think that we're definitely maybe trending more towards a time when this will be more more blessed by the judiciary, but I think at this point in time, from my opinion, I don't think that we're quite there yet.
Well, I think one of the aspects of this that has to be emphasized from a judicial perspective, we judges are just spending a lot of time in this area trying to get our hands around disproportion. In other words, with a mechanism or a metric that relates the amount of discovery to this case and how we do it. So someone like Megan is going to be perfectly capable of arguing to a court, Your Honor, we can spend this amount of money to do this, but we also can spend this amount of money, and the result we reach is more proportionate to what is truly at issue in this case. That second argument is a terribly attractive one to a judge, because it's what the judge is most concerned about. This, I got to stop this from getting out of hand. This just isn't the kind of case where $1 million on discovery makes any sense to anybody. As for the business executives, I appreciate something may leak out if the system isn't perfect, but I suppose we have to tell them that's what risk is all about, and they're business people. They therefore know how to assess that risk. I wrote recently about this and pointed out how important it is for lawyers to permit their clients to make truly informed judgments. Indeed, you may have a case where you may want to simply refer them to another lawyer outside your firm for additional guidance when they have to proportion risk to benefit. But I think that is the kind of sophisticated world in which we live. I don't think we have any choice anymore. Things are just running too far ahead of us.
And I think that if that is true indeed, then the more educated that the litigators become with respect to this technology and these issues, which is still a far way off, I think that you'll agree. They're getting better, but it's not all litigators that are ready to discuss and argue these issues. But to the extent that both sides do agree to something that is, by most standards, reasonable, then yes, I doubt that a court would refuse its blessing based on the fact that both parties are agreeing.
It sounds like you got to make it transparent as well. So you got to understand it, but you got to make it transparent to be able to explain what you did and why you're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. When I taught trial advocacy, I told my students that if they couldn't explain a legal concept to a 12-year-old child, they didn't understand it. That's still true.
Well, on that note, we've taken e-discovery from the mess down to we got to get it to where a 12-year-old child understands it.
Most 12-year-old kids I know will probably understand it a lot better.
the battle of a parent.
Yes.
Now you're speaking my pain point.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, this has been fantastic. We've had a couple of people twittering about we just want to get away from manual review, and I think this has been really helpful.
Good.
So I want to thank both of you for appearing on the show. I hope we can have both of you back on future shows. I'd like to let people know for a complete list of shows, they can visit www.esibytes.com, where we've got shows indexed by topic, speaker, and a variety of methods. So remember to visit ESI Bytes to learn tips about electronic discovery and records management before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Schinneman from Chernov. Thanks a lot. Have a nice day.
Okay.